Yeah, we're used to dealing with the press and being misquoted, and so we're sort of paranoid about that, more than just sensitive. Okay, after I sent you that email with that, what was really not a paper, it was just a letter to Friedman, I began to feel a little bit badly, like maybe I shouldn't have done it. The 1970s is a long way away now, but I had sort of forgotten just how much emotion the name Milton Friedman aroused at places like the Federal Reserve Bank, and I may have sounded unduly harsh on Columbia in the letter. I was more trying to get reactions from Friedman. So anyways, I had a little bit sort of misgivings of
FSL. Don't worry about it.
Well,
as of that time, although I'm afraid in later years in different ways also they've really fallen behind.
Well, they're coming back, but I know Fand. I'm sure Fand was not the source of your comments about Friedman being something of a domineering person himself.
Well, yeah, partly, but not to Fand. It was a question of which side of Friedman you were on.
Yeah, well, let's start.
But anyhow, I know that's not the intent.
Yeah. Let me just say that while I think of it, before I forget it, I have a way of kind of losing my train of thought. Your article in Challenge magazine, maybe December of 1999, something in that date.
I'm trying to remember because it wasn't written for them. It was some other paper that I wrote.
No, I just recall it.
Was that about the disappearance of the government debt, possibly?
No, it was a remarkably accurate forecast of everything that's happened.
Oh, I remember that article now, yeah. That was written actually by Jeff Madrick would have been the interlocutor on that article.
You said that equity prices were unsustainable.
Oh, yeah, now I remember. Thank you. I'm sorry. It's not that I've written so much, but it happened that I knew this was an interview I did with Jeff Madrick, who's been around. I guess he wrote or still writes for the Times some these days, and he wound up publishing it in Challenge magazine.
You were also critical of a lot of the new paradigm rhetoric, and this came right at the peak of the speculation in the bubble. There must be some kind of law that the more accurate one's predictions turn out to be ex post, the less is one is believed at the time.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But I have to tell you that I'm not in the habit of publishing a lot or writing things that I've never fortunately been in the business of having to write something every day or every week or even every month.
It's really quite extraordinary as a prognosis.
Thank you, sir.
It may seem obvious now, but it was certainly not obvious at the time. And that's one reason for doing history, because kind of nothing.
By the way, I would not have been the only one. But a lot of what you it has to do with what is chosen to be published.
Absolutely. We could talk about that for a long time.
Yeah. Even the Federal Reserve Bank had monthly reviews, I might add. A little bit.
Sure. Let me ask you, this is so personally of interest to me. My son's godfather was Paul Felber, his wife Elsie Felber. They were Jewish and from Vienna, and they left in 1939. In fact, they were on the last boat that was able to leave. I think it left from Cherbourg. Paul Felber, his cousin, is Thomas Mayer, who's an economist.
Yeah, that's the name I recognize.
At UFC Davis. So that was just a little interesting to me that you and the Felbers left the same year, 1939.
It is interesting, and I'm sorry to say that I never, our paths never crossed. Although professionally, we've had to take 15, 20 years for that sort of thing to happen, because I assume they were also quite young. Well, some of them at the age, anyhow.
Well, they were quite a bit older than you. Actually, Paul Felber had studied economics. When I looked through his papers after he died, I found that his orals were signed by Eugen von Böhm-Bawer.
Oh, my. Oh, my. All right.
Although he became a lawyer. So what date did your family leave in 39?
It would have been, I don't remember exactly, but it wouldn't have been the first week of September. The week the World War broke out between Germany and Poland, which would have been right around Labor Day that year, as memory serves.
So if you'd left, you couldn't have left any later.
Well, there was that war between Germany and the United States at that time.
Uh-huh. So your family moved to New York City?
Yeah, my parents, and I moved to actually in Brooklyn at the time, and later to New York City. That's right. And I don't have any siblings, so there wasn't that complication.
What was your father's profession?
My father was a lawyer in Vienna, which was a relatively ranking profession there because they had a guild, and there were only, I think, 2,000 lawyers in the city of 2 million people. I don't know what the U.S. ratio is, but yeah. Certainly have to add at least 1-0. But in the United States, he couldn't practice law, so he became an insurance salesman and wound up partly with the help of the war doing quite well at that.
Yeah.
The main legacy of that is, although it wouldn't have been important in the event, when my parents became affluent enough so that financing my studies was not a worry, my father said I could anything except law. Well, they wanted medicine, but I wasn't interested in medicine, as you well understand, of European parents' desires.
You would have, your father would have known Paul Felber. He became an accountant when he came to New York
City.
They moved to Chicago. So Columbia was an obvious place for you to start your studies?
Well, I graduated from Stuyvesant to New York, and Columbia was the obvious place because in those days, going away to school didn't seem like an obvious thing to do at all, so that was the best place to go in New York, and that's how it wound up.
So you were an undergraduate and graduate student?
Yeah, so I have 3 degrees from Columbia, yeah.
And when did you start studying economics?
I think at Columbia as a sophomore, economics was an elective, and it seemed kind of an obvious subject for me to take, and I liked it, and that's how it all went on. I think if I had been very good at physics, maybe I would have chosen physics, but economics is much easier.
Well, do you remember the names of any of your teachers?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Don't ask me more recent things. I forget those.
Yeah.
But the first teacher was Professor Carey, C-A-R-E-Y. I don't know that there's anything in economics that would have been known about him. But he was a big man on Columbia, about football and all sorts of campus organizations and so on and so forth. At that level, I should add, he was a very good teacher. I shouldn't. I only remember that at first midterm, the only person to get as high as a B+ was one of the athletes who later barely passed. But that's another matter. after that, there would have been a professor. If you might not heard, I'm surprised. His name is Oleg Hofting. He came from Scandinavia somewhere. HOEFFTING.
I hired a research assistant who subsequently went back to school and is now back here as an economist, Alex Woolman, and his great uncle, Leo Woolman, taught labor economics.
Yeah, those are the graduates. You know, at that time, and still, even more so subsequently, it's segregated. If you're an undergraduate, you didn't get to see those people.
Okay.
Because of a peculiar system that Columbia had, I got my bachelor's in 3 years in the summer, so I didn't have the many electives, you might say. And you were not required to have a major or minor at that time, maybe still not. You had to have what was called maturity credits. In other words, advanced courses meant you could graduate even if they were all over the lot.
I'm asking these questions for a reason. I sort of tell you where I'm going. Most of the people who went, or at least a lot of the people who went to the Fed and through the New York Fed, came through Harvard and John Williams. So you came from a different source.
I came from a very curious kind of connection. Let's put it that way. When I graduated, I had a bachelor's and master's, but my PhD was some years away. And I couldn't find a job in economics at first at all because the Columbia Placement Office was, how shall I put it, not cooperative, which was, although I couldn't prove it in court, perhaps because I was Jewish, because I graduated first in the class with 2 degrees and they didn't give me one job referral of any kind. So I went eventually to the Jewish organization, and they said that that although they couldn't find me a job, they would make sure that I got some referrals from Columbia, and they were right about that. And among those referrals from Columbia, which came within days after I talked to that Jewish organization, was one to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Well, I mentioned in my email that what prompted this letter to Friedman was reading Mo Abramovitz's autobiography. Very interesting. It you can download it from the Stanford Economics Department website. One of the reasons he left for Stanford was that he was teaching at Harvard, and Harvard was unwilling to promote Jacob Viner because the president of Harvard wouldn't promote Jews. So
that's also why Samuelson went to MIT maybe earlier before that.
I think that was a little later for...
Later, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But in any event, so I think that at the New York Fed, was it Rosa who was...
That's right. He was in charge at that time.
And from what I've heard, that Rosa would not discriminate on the basis of religion or gender, that he was willing...
That's right.
Somebody told me the story that at that time, when you went down to the cafeteria at the New York Fed, this was 1940, that the women sat on one side and the men sat on the other, and kind of Rosa, had female economist come sit on their side, little things like that.
Good for him. I know that, although I wasn't there that early, but that I was told that until after the war, blacks were not hired for anything except menial positions at the Fed. And some of the hangovers of that were still in evidence when I was there. And most of the Jewish economists like me left before they became promoted to higher positions, which became later on, not very much later, all the discrimination was scourged, but in the years that I was there, that was still a factor. As long as you're mentioning names, I should mention Rosa's a right-hand person who I thought was also exceptional in regard. His name is Charles Coombs, COOMBS.
Sure.
Who was really the operating manager of all the research people, and who, while in many ways a controversial figure, this is one score all across the board on which deserves a plus.
Somebody told me once Coombs was a roommate of Kennedy's at Harvard. Had you heard that?
I hadn't heard that, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Uh-huh. So, Coombs was a forceful personality.
He was the person who hired me, if you want to, I mean, maybe under Rosa's, gave the authority, but in terms of the person that I had to impress, so to speak, to be hired, he was the person.
Okay, I want to ask you about your... Okay, so I'm going to ask you about the relation, to what extent Volcker was a protege of Rosa, but I'm also going to ask you about the extent, I'm going to ask you about Arthur Burns and Alan Greenspan, too, because they have a lot in common. we'll get to that. So when did you start graduate study?
Mm-hmm. I was class of 51 of the college, but in the school year 51, I was already taking all my graduate courses.
Mm-hmm. So, you also started at the New York Fed in 1951, right?
No. I beg your pardon. That would have been, I think, 53. Because I went, my memory may be off a bit, but... It would be 51. Yes, I've got my... Basically, from my point of view, I got my bachelor's in 1950, my master's at the end summer 51, then I went to work at the Fed. That's right. Your record is more accurate than my memory.
So tell me about the courses you took from Arthur Burns.
By the way, I went to work in the... in what was called, I think, the Central European Unit. The fact that I knew German was key to my credentials, and that the person who was then in charge was, at least at that time, quite a famous econometrician by the name of Horst Mendershausen, who had already given up on econometrics. He was doing only political economy by the time he came to the Fed. But he had been at Rand and other such places.
Yeah, I definitely know the name and have read some things by him. Did John Williams work with your section?
No, John was by that time at Harvard, was it, and was an outside advisor.
So he would talk to Sproul, but he would not come down to Europe.
No, I remember whether he talked to Rose, I have no idea, but certainly not to any ordinary mortals.
Mm-hmm. So did you see Rosa and Coombs in your section, or were they?
Coombs mainly. The Federal Reserve was then, more so than now, but I suspect the Federal Reserve still has some of that attitude. A very hierarchical place. Mm-hmm. And that these people were on a different floor.
Yes.
And for me to communicate with Rosa would have been sort of through memos, none of which could pass back and forth without being edited by, from me to him, without being edited at two levels in between.
Yeah, I don't think that's changed over the years.
Which meant often they didn't come out to say what they were intended to, but that's another matter.
So you began work at the Fed at an extraordinarily interesting time. In terms of the international situation, the beginning of the Korean War in June of 1950, and then it's when it heated up in November of 50, when the Chinese crossed the Yalu River, the rise in commodity prices. Germany had just started with the European Payments Union, and there was a balance of payments crisis within the EPU. This was probably the last time that Germany, that the mark was under attack for being a weak currency. Was your unit involved in those kinds of...
Our unit was primarily involved with Germany and some with commodity prices. I'll get back to that in a moment. But of course, you know, the things that you mentioned, you know, I know by hindsight that as a 21-year-old kid out of school, all this EPU stuff seemed, you know, in another world so far as I was concerned at that juncture in time. Mm-hmm. The other member of our unit, in addition to Mendeshausen, was Alan Holmes, who later became manager of the Earth Market account, and who knew Russian. And so he was concerned with that end of it, and he was also the expert on commodity prices, would you believe?
Unfortunately, he died before I started.
Yeah, and you know, he died prematurely, yes. I was with very good reason, very junior, but you're quite right about the events at that time. But I would say that my analytical understanding or contribution would have been minimal at that point.
How was it that Holmes knew Russian?
Good question. I don't know. But he had access to the State Department. You know, we got some kind of consular reports, and he had access to the ones from Russia at a higher level of confidentiality than the rest of us did.
Do you remember it being an intellectually exciting place to work?
Well, absolutely, because it was very hard for young economists to get a job, mm-hmm. and I don't want to be self-congratulatory, but you know, you had only pretty good young people.
Yeah.
And Bob Reza himself was at that time also a leader, you know, in the branch of the profession. So all that stuff about availability, you know, and so forth. So it was an exciting place. But I was transferred to the domestic side after a couple of years, which was sort of a promotion. And that's basically where my intellectual process.
Okay, well, let me go back to the courses. You got your PhD somewhat later, so were you taking courses at Columbia throughout the 50s?
No, when I came to the Fed, I only needed three more courses, which I took at NYU. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the time was involved in the thesis, which for a long time I really didn't start, and which really I owed to to the Federal Reserve, if you want to have that on your record, in that when after I'd been there, whatever it was, 9 or 10 years, and started looking for other jobs, as was the custom, one of the incentives maybe that Rosa developed was that if you'd been there a certain while and were chosen, that the Fed would give you 6 or 9 months off to do your PhD dissertation, and they would give it to you off at the office. So you had all the facilities of that to work through.
Was that before the Bureau and the Fed with Dan Brill began work on the flow of funds accounts?
It would have been, I think, co-terminus.
Mm-hmm.
But it was when Arthur Burns was in charge of the Bureau by name, and Jeff Moore was really running it.
Mm-hmm.
And also Arthur Burns was my thesis chairman. That was part of his involvement, you might say. But Jeff Moore was also on my committee, and he really is the one who passed my thesis. And after he had passed it, Arthur Burns made me write, for very good reasons, I must say, another draft of it. And that's how the whole thing came to be done. And but all of that didn't start until I had been without doing anything on the thesis for several years.
What courses did you take from Arthur Burns? So you didn't take courses from him?
No.
Did you have any sense of him as an economist at that time?
Very little, other than that he was feared by everyone, and that he had this remarkable gift of speaking, even in ordinary speech, with punctuation marks included. I mean, not that he said period or semicolon, but you could have taken his anything he said that would have been in perfect English. I got when he became chairman of the board, which was already at the time when from First Boston I was visiting the board, and naturally I went to see him. I learned more about his economics then and some of his lacks than subsequently. He knew nothing about finance so far as I could tell. And it was my intention not to go to see him very much, because every time I or anyone else came to see him, he would leave me, he said, with some sort of thing that he would say, write me a memo about that. So you couldn't go to see him without knowing it was going to take a lot of time after that. And then so I went to see, as I do nowadays, other members of the board, but as you know, there's a list of the visitors there, and I got a call from his secretary, I guess that was already Miss Malarty, saying he wants to know why he didn't come to see him. So that's the kind of person he was.
So this is in 1970 that you visited the board?
Yeah. So my acquaintance with Arthur Burns really is, other than the fact that my thesis was, and on the Orwells, I was under some attack, if that's the right word, or criticism from the other members, that when the chips were down, he defended me. So I should admit that.
Did you see a relationship between Arthur Burns and Alan Greenspan? They both came... Greenspan studied under Burns and had a National Bureau sort of disposition of looking at the data and always trying to understand empirical relationships and how they evolved in response to changes. You know, both Burns and Greenspan were consummate business forecasters, making use of, you know, the leading indicators approach. Did that ever occur to you that...
It should have, but I confess that it didn't, but you're quite right about it. Everything except your use of the term consummate, I think they both were terrible business forecasters, because they were competition of mine, so I have a judgment of who was good and who wasn't. And both of them, because until Greenspan came to the Fed, or at least came to the government, he had no understanding of how monetary policy was involved in anything. He was always a fiscal policy person, still is to some extent. But unlike Burns, Greenspan has really become an expert on monetary policy on the job, which, to my judgment, Burns never managed or cared about at all.
Yeah, everyone I've talked to has said the same thing. For example, board staff, they were surprised when Burns came to the Fed how little he knew about the Federal Reserve System and monetary policy.
Now, and personality-wise, as you know, they were, of course, very different. I mean, of course, Greenspan was born in the U.S., if I'm right.
Yes.
And as a young person, I mean, maybe That has nothing, but you're quite right about the intellectual antecedents. You're absolutely right about them.
But there's one enormous difference, which is that Burns was willing to use incomes policies to control inflation, and they were anathema to Greenspan ideologically. And so both of them despised inflation. But if you despise inflation and you're unwilling to use government coercion, all you've got left is monetary policy. If you are willing to use government, then you feel like you can trade off. And so there's one... There's
now, you know, I have respect for Greenspan, and you can't speculate on what would have been done had he been there instead of Burns. But, you know, as you know, when you have responsibilities and when you're dealing with the president and so forth, there are times when you make compromises. So I wouldn't think less of Greenspan if he had been there when Burns was there and we'd had incomes policy at that time. I think that was... You may have some indication of where the ideas for the incomes policy came from. And I personally, I wouldn't be surprised if it came more from Volcker than from Burns.
Well, at that time, Well, for example, in 1970, Robert Rosa gave a speech at the whatever the Finance Association is, and he argued for a six-month wage freeze to change psychology, and that's what people like Volcker and Weidenbaum, you know, who is a very conservative person, that was a common kind of view, that there was an inflation mentality that had to be stopped, and the way to stop the psychology was for a freeze for 6 months. Burns, my own feeling is...
And actually, you know, I didn't anticipate it, and I was against it from the very beginning, but it might have worked if monetary policy hadn't, in effect, undercut it.
Well, that's an interesting point.
I'm not trying to justify it by hindsight, don't let me... but it was really used, and this you can blame Burns for, at least in part, is to take the heat off money, off the Federal Reserve from a monetary point of view.
Yeah, I'm asking these questions for a reason, because I'm eventually going to ask you about Paul Volcker and whether you think his views changed over time, or... Whether
sure, yeah, well, from experience. Also, if memory serves, this was when Connally was Secretary of the Treasury.
Yes.
And Connally was the man who gave orders. My hunch is, not from knowledge, that Volcker planted that idea in his mind, but that when Connally heard of it, he would have grasped it, you know, to his bosom right away. After that, you couldn't change anything. You know, there would have been no way to undo it. That's my hunch, not based on anything that Paul told me.
Yeah, well, my hunch is that Burns, ever since he was head of the MBER, sat on a lot of corporate boards. Like Greenspan, he was, you know, sort of be a business forecaster. I think it was a lucrative thing for him, and he always thought he had an insight into the psychology of the businessman, and a lot of his ideas really reflected the conventional views of the business community at the time, and I think that's where they came from, because the business community was very much in favor of controls. Now, when they said controls, they meant wage controls and price controls.
That's right. Absolutely. You've got that totally right, and it was a great irony at that time that the business community were the ones who pushed this idea, which I suspect a lot of historians have, or people who talk about this history, would like to overlook.
Well, at the time you said you were opposed to the controls. What was the basis for your opposition?
Basically, because I didn't think that they would work, and I thought that you'd have to have much tighter money, period. Mm-hmm. And that controls would create an illusion
another good forecast.
Yeah, no, I should tell you also in terms of bad forecasts, that on one of the very rare occasions, I had a tip-off from a reporter. The weekend when the controls were introduced, he told me it was going to happen, and I told him that he was crazy.
I wonder who that reporter was, because it was very...
Well, I can tell you who it was, because he's dead. It's Sandy Parker from Fortune.
Hmm.
But, you know, I mean, this is probably not relevant. Yeah. There's no harm in your knowing, but it's kind of, to the side of the whole business.
Yeah, it was very closely held. I mean, people like Herb Stein at the council didn't know about
it. Sandy didn't tell me that this was going to happen, but everybody knew it was going to be discussed. And he said, I want to tell you that there's been an emergency meeting called over the weekend at Camp David.
Oh, okay.
And this is probably what will come out of it.
That's what he got onto. Well, somebody could have made a lot of money at that point if they had...
That's right. So you can say that I missed doing that because it didn't seem logical.
I was interested in your comment about Burns and Greenspan as forecasters. I also have my own prejudices, which is that forecasting real economic activity, the fluctuations around trend is an almost impossible job, and that what, quote, forecasters at the Fed do is very efficiently combine all available information to get the best possible estimate of what the economy is doing contemporaneously. But nobody is forecasting in a meaningful sense, not Burns or not Greenspan. Now, you may disagree with that, and you made some comments about Burns and Greens.
Well, I think that in the broad sense, what you said about the Fed, which I respect very highly, and I was on very good terms with Mike Pell, and I hope to be with...
Well, Stockton.
Stockton, I'm sorry, I'm bad on... I told you, current names are difficult at my age. But I do think that, and having worked at the Fed myself, that any place where I have to put together a forecast by committee, even if some people in the committee have very little voice, is doomed from the start. But I do still, not just because of I was young at the time, I still do believe in business cycles.
Sure.
And I think that the one reason why econometrics has its problems is they're simply that I'm not sure that I would divide them up into nine phases the way Mitchell did, but that there simply aren't enough cases of what you might call business cycle observations for econometrics to work with them.
Oh, that sounds so much like Greenspan. Greenspan took a lot of courses over the years at Columbia, and he took all the econometrics courses. And Greenspan's view of economics is his view of econometrics, and his argument is always that the models are fitted to particular historical episodes, but they don't forecast because the world changes, and it's never quite the same as what it was when the model was fit. And I was interested in your comments.
Well, for better or worse, you can love me with that view.
Yeah, you say, if the choice were starkly between Mitchell on the one hand and econometrics based on economic theory on the other with no middle ground, I would stand with Mitchell.
Yeah,
so,
because as a shortcut, the intrinsic thing is not what's the same, but what's different.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what...
And usually, one isn't... I don't claim to be always right, or that would like to think that, but... and usually when things are different, it's natural for the majority to say that somehow they don't count and they're out of line and should be ignored,
mm-hmm.
whereas more often than not, in the very short run sense, they create the different observations, would be my judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But not in any sense scientifically proven or verified on my part.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that sense, Burns and Greenspan are similar, and it takes a long period to pass judgment, but for Burns, the salient fact was that in 1970 you had 6% unemployment, which was 2 percentage points above what everybody thought was full employment, and you still had 6% inflation. So he had not seen that in his business cycle data, so he assumed that it was cost push pressure, and Burns was very, like the businessmen of the time, he was very hostile to the labor unions. Now, Greenspan, I think, did a similar thing when he saw productivity growth pick up in after 1996 and trumpeted the new economy. And he may be right ultimately, but he may also be wrong. But I think it's a similar intellectual exercise that the two went through, this business of seeing what's different and then trying to give content to it at the time, rather than, you know, wait for 20 years and enjoy the historical perspective, and then you can go back and say, oh yeah. But in that sense, I think they're similar intellectually, that they have this Columbia Mitchell Bureau empirical kind of bent to identify empirical regularities, flag differences, and try to understand those differences in terms of changing institutional arrangements.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation on your part, and yeah, I'm sure you're right about that.
Okay. You made, before we leave Burns, you made one other little comment that was interesting to me. You said that, not your words, but if Greenspan had been board chairman in 1972 and had considered himself counselor to the president, he too might have made a different set of compromises than he made later on. And so you view Burns as close to the Nixon administration, at least after the wage and price controls, and that was a problem for monetary policy.
Yeah, well, I can't, you know, I can't comment, would not have been in position to comment specifically, but that Burns was a stalwart in the Republican Party, you know, and his credentials mm-hmm. were beyond the question, so on and so forth, all suggest that he and Nixon would have communicated very well on a subject like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Burns did want to be an advisor to Nixon. Burns also wanted to be an insider so that he could influence the wage guidelines.
Yeah. So you mentioned Joseph Stein, because although I'm not sure that in fundamental view between him and Burns there would have been a great difference, but Joseph Stein would not have been that kind of personality. He was not trying to be president by proxy, as in some sense Burns was.
Mm-hmm. Or Paul Volcker. Now, Paul Volcker is an interesting example. Volcker, this was an expression somebody else, Chuck Lucas, used for me when I was in the job market in 1975. He said Volcker's the Potomac River type. That is, he can't stay away from government. He really wants to be in government. But I know this sounds sort of corny, and you can tell me, but he's a odd, unusual example of somebody who's really a public servant, that he wanted to be in government, but he was never political. He was never, I mean, sure, you work for Connolly, you've got to be political, you've got to be politically astute, but he wasn't in there because of the politics of it. I mean,
you're absolutely right in that Paul was the epitome of what I think of as a British civil servant. Grew up in, and I've never known a more selfless person than he.
Okay, sure.
He and I worked for a while. We shared an office at the New York Fed. Because Rosa spotted him early on as a genius, and I became quite demoralized because Volcker would come in with his work perfectly done, and I asked him when he did it, and he would say at 2 in the morning or something like that. I'm not capable of working after 10 at night. So eventually, quite literally, what happened, just as a personal note, was that Volcker was working with open market operations, which were, of course, the key path to moving ahead. And I was shifted to business conditions because, to quote my boss's, my boss was Bill Gaines, who has passed away, but you've got him in your records there, I'm sure.
Sure. Volcker admired William McChesney Martin, and I think it must have been for Volcker and his resignation. Volcker could have had the job again if he had asked for it, but he wanted the administration to call him and to assure him that the job would be his, that people would not be sniping at him, that they would just let him do it, and the administration wasn't willing to make that phone call. They were happy for him to leave, and so they just parted company.
Yeah, well, I was not at a level to know the total inside of this, other than by inference from Paul, pardon the first name, whether they would have wanted some more affirmative announcement from him than just the question of the phone call. I would simply say I'm not sure. I would leave that as a question.
Mm-hmm.
Personal matters, he was very reticent. Now, I mentioned we had a group of couples that met at that time from time to time. Volcker and his wife, my wife and I, Henry Kaufman and his wife, Elaine, and sometimes Jack Hennessy, who was at the Treasury, sometimes Charlie Sanford, who resigned from Bankers Trust. You know that name, I guess.
So that's interesting.
Charlie Sanford was chairman of Bankers Trust eventually. And we never talked about business at those social meetings, gatherings, in somebody's home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then once in a long while, Paul would bring up something having to do with business.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the rest of us looked at each other because we said, now we're going to hear something that he wants to have circulated in the community.
Yeah.
Whether it's being used. Otherwise, the subject would never come up in social matters.
Well, that's what people say about Volcker, who had dealing with him, that he was the consummate bureaucrat, that he never tipped his own hand. If you want to say, well, what did he think about in 1970 about a crawling peg, you know, the kinds of reforms that were discussed. And people would say, well, you don't know, because he came and, you know, he ran the meetings, but he always represented his boss and the Treasury and his position, and you never knew what his individual position was. He was a very competent bureaucrat.
I think when he became chairman, that may have eased a little, but not totally by any means.
So, was there anybody he confided in, as far as you know?
In the sense that you're describing?
Yeah.
Well, a person who has been mentioned, although I would hate to believe it, is, no, Jack Hennessy, I forget what his first name, true first name is, who was assistant to Paul when he was in the Treasury. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And later became chairman of First Boston, and is now retired but still active there, and a bright but duplicitous sort of person, if I may say. and he and Paul really they seem to operate a lot together, even after Hennessy left the Treasury. So you might get a kind of slightly different impression there.
Okay. Do you think he would talk to me?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay. Huh. Yeah, I definitely know the name, but.
And he's partly retired and so forth. I don't see why he wouldn't.
Sure.
And for many years, he harbored ambitions of running for president.
Okay, let's go back to the early Fed days. When did you transfer to the domestic section?
I would have been 53.
Did you have any contact with board people at that time? Riefler, Young, Thomas, and then...
No, they were all very important names.
Yeah, and then Leach and Youngdahl, they were younger economists. Then they left and went to...
Right. Now, when they left, I got to know them quite well, including my younger son, who was at Goldman Sachs, but that was long after.
Mm-hmm.
Not only when they left, but I left also, I guess I should add.
Mm-hmm. Did you retain an interest in the international when you... later on in the 50s, I'm interested especially in the period of 58, 59, when the Fed became concerned about foreign confidence in the dollar. There was an episode very much like Volcker's flight to Belgrade in August 1979, and, you know, the discussion of foreign central bankers and their concern about the dollar, and the story is Volcker flies back, and it was in, it would have been October 1958, Secretary Anderson flies to New Delhi, there's an IMF conference, and there's a similar concerns about the dollar, and he flies back, and the Eisenhower administration decides that it's going to make price stability its priority, and they try to balance the budget, and the Fed raises
the inflation. You have really, I can see that you've done an enormous amount of research in this area. The fact was that I really didn't become, so to speak, re-involved on the international side until the latter 60s, in that series of episodes. By then I was at First Boston, and basically, you know, I was an early economist and would, in effect, be for a very long time, so I was in charge of everything, you might say. And if something was very much in the news, which of course turned out to be the case, then I could claim that I had some experience on the international side, although it wasn't very germane. So I can't address the late 50s question is simply no.
Did you have any...
I can say that on the domestic side it made no impression at all.
Yeah. Did you have contact with Volcker During the 1950s when he was at the Treasury?
Let's see, when did he go to the Treasury? Sometime, was it?
Well, it would have been with the Kennedy administration. Rosa would have brought him in, and that would have been 61.
50, late 50s and 60s. But in any case, the fact of the matter is that to a greater or lesser extent, I had contact with Volcker all the time, either socially or professionally, but that it became much more meaningful when I left the Federal Reserve,
mm-hmm.
which would have been in the 60s.
Do you have any sense of why he left the Treasury in fall 65 to go back to Chase Manhattan? In the Nixon administration, somebody who's just very, very competent, and even in a political organization, you need somebody who understands the issues. He had a son and a daughter, and the son had multiple sclerosis. She had arthritis,
rheumatoid arthritis, I mean, from a very young age, and became increasingly crippled.
Okay, I didn't know that it is.
No. The last, she died, I would guess it's about 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and the last 10 or more years of her life, she was a very, very bright and vivacious woman when she was young, but she was basically wheelchair ridden and could.
Did you have contact with Volcker during the Nixon administration at the Treasury, and particularly what I'm thinking, in Changing Fortunes, in his book, he expresses frustration at the unwillingness of the Nixon administration to the Fed, to defend the Bretton Woods system. Its exclusive focus on domestic policy, when focusing on the dollar would have been useful too. It would have forced them to confront inflation more directly. Do you feel like the frustration he felt in the Treasury at that time, as someone who was responsible for maintenance of the Bretton Woods system and seeing it break up before his eyes, that must have been something he carried with him when he became chairman of the FOMC? That's speculation, of course.
I don't know that this is advanced with your question or with what you're saying, but I'd like to say that Paul always had, he is someone who wanted the United States to be the leader in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say to him, how can, a country, have, both a huge export surplus and a very strong currency and no inflation and so on and so forth, all these good things which are very hard to join together in, and a balanced budget and who knows what other things might have been involved. Do we believe that the United States should always be associated with the best of everything? In that sense, he was a super patriot. And to me, as a lesser person and also as a forecaster, at times these goals obviously came into conflict. And he never responded, you might say, to that sort of issue. He always was trying to figure out a way for the U.S. to be in the lead. And so I don't know that it's not the Bretton Woods institutions per se, but the role of the United States in being the leader and setting the benchmark for other countries to follow if they want to be doing the best.
That's a very interesting insight. So Volcker has always expressed concern for the behavior of the dollar, and always expressed the idea that monetary policy should concern itself with the dollar. He'd like to see a movement back toward
fixed rate.
Yeah. So that's not just because in the 50s and 60s, coming through the New York Fed, and the Treasury, he was part of the establishment that was in charge of maintaining the Bretton Woods system, and that was his formative years. It's what you say about the role of the United States in the world. A strong dollar for him is part of the United States.
Yeah, I would be hard put to it if you were to tell me, well, if someone were to say that he had a strong belief, for example, in fixed exchange rates for their own sake, mm-hmm. I would be hard pressed. He had a strong belief in those things that put the United States in a positive and affirmative fashion at the center of the world.
Yeah, that's a very interesting comment, because I've often wondered about that, because Volcker was very intellectual. He was like John Williams or Rosa in that sense, in that he was very intellectual, but he never signed on to a particular intellectual movement, whether it was Keynesianism or monetarism or
rational
expectations. He was a policy person, let's make the world run. But he was intellectual. He understood how the world works. So he obviously knew all the arguments for what it took to make it work.
I can say from personal experience, as well as others, better than the people who themselves propose these arguments. He could make anybody's case better than the individual that I know of.
Yeah. So in that
sense, that didn't mean that he persuaded him, of course.
Yeah. So in that sense, well, that explains then his attachment to an international system which keeps the dollar strong.
Yeah. Right.
But in that sense, he was different from Charlie Coombs. You I've read Coombs' book and things that he said, and Coombs was also the consummate manager, the person who made things run. He came out of the Cold War a generation earlier than Volcker, and his generation, like Kennedy, believed in the strength of the dollar as a patriotic thing. The dollar had to be strong because the free world had to be strong, and you had a communist menace. And Coombs, somebody told me he was in the CIA in Greece in the Civil War.
I don't know from whom, but I've heard.
Yeah. So, but Coombs was not intellectual. At least when you read his book, there's never any sense that he understood the intellectual arguments. His view was always an operational market view, and what do we need to do to get cooperation? You know, who do I need to call on the phone to get this done? And surely he understood the issues, the need for, you know, monetary policy that was consistent with maintaining the value of the dollar. But his emphasis was always, you know, on the operations. You know, how do we get cooperation to make this work? But so that, in that sense, you know, Volcker was really unusual. He was different from Volcker and Rosa. They were different from Coombs.
Yes, that's right. I didn't know Rosa well, so
of interesting, because it seems like Volcker's, if you want to understand Volcker, you need to understand Rosa. But, you know, they overlap. They were in different situations, but I think a lot of Volcker's attitudes and views came through Rosa in the New York thread. And Rosa was an intellectual. He also had a sense of kind of integrity in what he believed, and people have said that by challenging Martin on the bills only policy and by aligning himself with Sproul, that he foreclosed his future within the Federal Reserve System. There were limits to how far he could rise, and he must have known. Now, whether, you know, it's kind of debatable whether when Sproul left he could have been promoted president of the bank, because he was young at that time, so he had that going against him. But it was clear that Washington, you know, was going to veto. Washington did veto Sproul's candidate, and then they accepted a compromise.
I'm sorry, I wasn't aware of that, but I find that very interesting and not surprising. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I talked to Bill Treiber, and that's what he told me. Okay. So, Volcker is president of the New York Fed. This is about where I came in, because I joined the Fed in fall of 1975. Volcker was a very articulate member of the FOMC. Unfortunately, the transcripts from that period are still not available, but from my briefings, you know, from what I heard of the debates, you don't get the feeling that this is somebody who would lead a cavalry charge or was tremendously unhappy with how things are going. Now, this is speculation, but I get the feeling more that he's either holding his cards close to his vest, or when he's put in the position of being chairman of the Board of Governors in the FOMC, then he's a natural crisis manager. He rises to the occasion. He's somebody who can lead in difficult times. He's put in a difficult position, and he comes through. This, which is a little different than saying, oh yeah, he was like Milton Friedman, and he just believed you ought to control money, and money was growing too fast, and therefore, you know, he didn't come Paul Volcker, of, you know, that we know as head of the Fed from August 79 on, was partly created by the situation in which he was placed, and partly by this longer kind of tradition of, as you say, the New York Fed, and particularly the New York Fed's concern for the international situation, the value of the dollar, the role of the United States in the world economy. Do those things sound?
Yeah, I think that's all. That's very astute of you. I've not heard it this way, but I think you're absolutely right. And the idea of crisis management really fits him totally.
Mm-hmm. This is something he wouldn't have talked about at the time, but he pushes the funds rate up to 21%. It goes up in early 81 and then again in spring of 82. I mean, it seems like a couple of things are going on. He's looking back to William McChesney Martin and the kind of the earlier views of the importance of inflationary psychology, and what he's looking at, seems to me, is not so much money growth. Money growth is important because at this time the financial markets are concerned about it, and they associate high money growth with inflation. So he's got a derived concern for money growth, but he's looking through to the psychology of the markets, which is something Martin would have done and did do in 59 and 69. So in that sense, there's a continuity here. But he's also in a situation where Reagan just sits on his hands. He doesn't say anything. Reagan is not Lyndon Johnson in 1965. So Volcker pushes and finds he can get away with it. Nobody at the time expected just how difficult it would be. This is summer 1982, you're talking about?
Right. Basically, I think it was in November thereabouts, he made a speech, the burden of which was to say, well, who cares, you know, 20% is enough.
Well, we knew later, we didn't, at least at my level, we didn't know so much at the time, but what was changing was the LDC debt crisis, the invasion of the Malvin Islands by Argentina in that spring and the precipitation of the debt problems with Argentina and then Mexico, and the international banking system is under stress. And so Volcker begins to back off, and he finds that when he backs off, when he begins to lower the interest rate felicitously, or not felicitously, as a consequence of earlier policy, inflation's falling, and he finds that the Fed's got credibility, that he can lower interest rates and inflationary expectations remain under control. So, you know, he's got these things he's balancing off, and suddenly the calculus is different. He's got more flexibility than he had in the earlier period, and he's got this horrendous mess that's developing with the large banks. They're basically insolvent. But none of that becomes... Were you aware of that dimension of it?
Yes. But again, it fits into your into your sense that it was crisis which attracted his attention and best qualities.
Yeah, and I think that must... Maybe that explains his affinity with Jack Hennessy, from what you
maybe.
Told me about him. But it seems to me it certainly explains why he would choose somebody like Corrigan as an assistant, because Corrigan was a crisis fighter, too. He was somebody that Volker could rely on in a Hunt Brothers silver situation and so on, to get in, sort things out, knock heads, do whatever it took to clean up a mess, and again, Corrigan's very bright. You know, he would have understood all the intellectual issues, but he's basically sort of a street fighter person. Although
I assume that you either have talked to him or whatever.
No, I've not.
I mean, you know, if there's an opportunity.
Yeah.
Like,
I should do that. Yeah.
Although he's a very hard person from whom to draw a whole sentence of answer to anything. But to maybe worth trying anyhow. As we get older, we get maybe more garrulous.
Well, that's an interesting comment. He came up through the economics department, so he's, you know, he should be easy for an economist to talk to, but his natural proclivities seem to be operational. When he retired, he made the comment that he never read any of the text in the Blue Book, and Cohn or Prell commented, well, that's why we put lots of graphs in it for people like you. So I think that's indicative of what he liked to do. You know, what are the issues, and how do we confront them? I'm especially interested in how Volker went out and the Louvre Accord. In 84, there's another inflation scare. The economy recovers very strongly in 83, even though the Fed begins raising the funds rate, when I think the unemployment rate's still almost 11%, anyways, it's very high. The bond rates kind of rise to almost the heights they were in 81 and spring of 82. Volker again responds very dramatically, raises the funds rate, you know, puts the fires out. You go into 85, 86, trend inflation comes down to 4%, but you get the oil price shock, and for a while, CPI inflation, ex-food and energy, looks like you've almost got price stability. And kind of worldwide, it's looked like maybe you're getting deflation, worldwide recession. You get a huge protectionist kind of movement in the United States. Looks like the Coalition for Free Trade is going to fall apart. And then into all this, you get a change in secretaries of the Treasury. Baker replaces Reagan. And so at first you get Plaza, which is sort of cosmetic. It takes advantage of the fact that the dollar is already falling. But then Louvre becomes much more serious. It's what economists of the Yale School and the Fred Bergstons of the world had talked about for a long time, international coordination, where countries would get together and jointly decide fiscal policies and monetary policies. And so monetary policy becomes expansionary in early 87. Bond rates rise, and Volker this time kind of doesn't respond quickly to it. Do you have any insights into what's going on in this period?
International agenda.
The Germans were the ones who were raising interest rates. The Japanese didn't appear to be the problem at the time. Two things. One is, you know, it's very hard even...
And that had something to do with the Reagan people being glad to get rid of him.
So anyway, your impression is that there was tension at this time between Treasury and the Volcker, and between the Treasury people and
right.
and Volcker. I mean, there certainly was a lot of tension between the governors, the new Reagan appointees, Manny Johnson and Wayne Engel.
Yeah, right.
Those people who later became... inflation hawks, but
yeah, I mean, those people who later learned from their job,
yeah.
And who were put in to ask Volcker, and then from the standpoint of the Reagan administration, failed to do it. After they got corrupted into the environment, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense would be that the tension, I don't know if it was really, so to speak, on the staff level, or there would have had to be. But I think it was Baker and Volcker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Baker had which is what made Volcker the civil servant. I mean, Baker had a foreign policy, to put it in that framework. And Volcker had the choice of undercutting it or not.
Yeah, and I think that if Volcker had been reappointed, it wouldn't have made any difference, because he had enough credibility at that point that he could have. If Volcker had raised rates in the fall, people would have said, well, yeah, they're going to go up, and then they'll come back down. And Greenspan at the time, it's hard to go back and think of people who you know now so well. At that time, he was viewed the way Burns was when he
yeah.
came in. He was a Republican. He was close to the Republican Party. He didn't have any particular credibility in terms of inflation fighting. It was more difficult in fall of this year of 87 for Greenspan to get on top of inflation expectations. So I think Volcker could have ridden it out, but he wasn't reappointed, and I think that was short-sighted of the Reagan people. Ultimately, Greenspan became a giant in his own right, but at this point in 87, he didn't have that sort of reputation.
Yeah.
Or
yeah. Well, everybody in the Reagan administration, below Reagan and maybe Baker, I mean, they were just happy to get Volcker. They had been hunting for a scalp for a long time.
Yeah.
He was a Democrat, after all.
Yeah.
And in many ways, a liberal Democrat.
This is reminiscent of something that, kind of a snippet of a conversation I had with Frank Schott. He said that when Martin agreed to foreign exchange intervention in 1961, which really began in 62, that Rosa and Coombs just thought, his word was like, they fought like brothers over who was going to control the intervention. The reason he used the word brothers was that to the public, they presented a common facade, because as far as the public was concerned, he used the word Milton Friedman, they really saw the world very much the same way. But in terms of who was going to, of the control of, whether it was going to be a joint decision they both had to sign off on, or whether it was going to be a Treasury decision, was very contentious. And surely Coombs won that battle. As far as I know, the Fed has never agreed to foreign exchange intervention, except as an instance where it has said, yes, this is something we agree is appropriate, and we're willing to, you know, sign on.
Yeah, well, thank you, Speaker. I was not aware of the Frank was in the middle of those things, and I wasn't aware of that. When Paul was reappointed as chairman by Reagan the first time, which would have been whatever that was, 63, if that's the right time, I wrote him a brief note of congratulation, which is that you're the only Federal Reserve chairman to have been appointed to your job by presidents of different parties, in both cases against the advice of their president confidants.
Yeah.
And I think that was accurate.
Yeah, yeah. We've run through a lot of personalities. Do you have a broad sense of why the Fed went from doing a pretty good job in the 50s and early 60s to allowing it high and rising inflation, ultimately double-digit inflation by the end of the 70s, and you know why it came back on track with Volcker? Do you have some sense of why it went off so badly and under Burns, and actually even toward the end of for a while under Martin in 68?
Yeah, well, it's not something to which I've given consistent thought. An obvious answer is that, like so many other things that happened at that time, the forces of the Vietnam War had a lot to do with all of these things.
That's a good comment, and
it's not that they didn't want to. I mean, I'm still see occasionally Dewey Dane, who I'm sure is on your list somewhere.
Sure. Oh yeah. Pressures were direct.
Part of the whole, but I think if not for Vietnam, that whole attitude might have been different, too. They were fighting a war, and that was the number one priority.
Well, the pressures were direct and indirect. There were also riots in the city, and there was a general consensus that if you had a high unemployment rate, that would be very divisive socially, and it would the country was divided along these fault lines of for and against the war, the racial line, and Volcker's contribution was that he showed that not only he brought down inflation, yes, with a recession, and the Fed survived the recession, but he showed that you could maintain a low inflation rate with a politically acceptable unemployment rate, and we now take that for granted, but that was not something that people were
On that, it's not the time to get into an argument. is an important ingredient to getting business moving. And while this can be, and if the only way it seems to be to beat costs is by cutting labor costs, then you have what we have now. There might be other ways to do it which didn't require inflation. But I didn't. I'm sorry. I should not get off.
No, that's great.
On this tack, but that, in the.
That's fascinating. That's the Burns Mitchell.
That's right.
Viewpoint.
So. Right, and yeah. It has not been much held, but as of the moment, who knows what tomorrow brings? But as of
sure.
The moment,
sure.
Things got a lot going in its favor. Now, but going back to the earlier situation, also to bring up, it had always been my argument that the system of financial and interest rate controls or regulations, whatever you want to call it. Personally, I think we have much more severe regulation now than we did then, whereas now it's not effective, but then it was. But in any case, while this system lasted and it was doomed to fail, I think that people didn't appreciate sufficiently how these regulations maintained a low level of, lower than should have been level of interest in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that how, if you remove these regulations in what was anyhow an inflationary environment, that interest rates were going to go up literally zillion, dozens of basis points more than you expected, and that any monetary policy which in its, so to speak, equations didn't have changes of levels, just changes, period to period, short period to period changes, would always be surprised by how little on the economy was accomplished by the latest rise of the federal funds rate, because they didn't appreciate, in my judgment then and now, how far below, for want of a better word, I called it the free market level. The whole level of interest rates in the United States had been kept under the old system, but the gap that needed to be made up was enormous. So again, in these wartime conditions for a central bank to be raising rates in a way that everybody else said was substantial, and to find it effective, ineffective time after time in stopping inflation was almost, you might say, hindsight, a predictable kind of sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I had suggested, as I'm sure I did at one point to Walker, not that, instead of going for in the federal funds rate from 9% to 20-odd%, which was my forecast at the time, that if you would raise it to 15%, the 5%, even if he had agreed with that, which I doubt very much, it would have not been a practical policy. Although this is the way the British, in some sense, might have done it, but only because of the international aspects that gave them the backbone to do that kind of monetary policy. Anyhow, so I'm sorry to bring in, as it were, my own doctrinal history, such as it is, but I do think it has a bearing on these developments.
Well, surely it does, because the ability of the Fed to raise interest rates had a lot to do with Reg Q and disintermediation, and those are the things you don't, if you aren't careful about your history, those are the things that get forgotten, and people do these, that gets back to your point about fitting an econometric model, and then using